So there is a brief time for questions. Don't go too far, Andrew, because I'll be looking to you to answer them. Now, there is a brief time for questions, and borrowing from the RTC Monthly, where there's a little bit of an introduction to Andrew, he confessed to being excited by working with the students there and being amazed at the questions that they came with and the way that this would stretch him in his thinking. So I encourage you to seek to do that now. Is there opportunity to amaze Andrew and stretch his thinking and ours with the questions? So if there's... yeah, sure. If there's questions, I'll open that up now. Tim.
It's a question about that and not for a man. The question is, chapter 2, verse 7. John White says, he says, to those who... is he having in mind here a sort of a battle scene, or is there something else that he's looking at referring to there?
Sorry, Tim, you say John White, that's...
No,
John. Oh, sorry.
Chapter 2, verse 7.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's a recurring phrase in the closing. Sorry. That's a recurring phrase in the closing encouragement to him who overcomes. It is. I mean, it's the standard Greek verb for conquering. Winning the is nikao, from which you get your Nike training shoes, wearing which you will come first in the race, hopefully. And I think it is behind it the idea of taking part in the athletic contest and winning the prize, the victory prize at the end of the race, and. It's interesting how in each of the seven letters that prize is described in different ways, using different Old Testament analogies. But again, think of how Paul, he speaks about that. I think clearly with a distinctively Christian understanding, because in the athletic race, there's only one person who wins. It's a zero-sum game. You know, if you come first, Tim, it means I don't get the gold medal. But in this case, it's clearly a very different kind of race because those who are faithful, all of us will receive the prize. I'm not sure whether that addresses your question, but it's the promise to those who faithfully complete the course that's set in front of them.
Mentioned that in the first chapter, the stars represent the angels of the churches, and you get into a view that the angels were the teachers or the pastors, the ministers of the respective churches. Beginning of this letter to Ephesus, it says, to the angel of the church. And I noticed that all the you words, the pronoun you, throughout the letter, in the singular. What do we make of that? I mean, it seems clear that the letters are for the churches, but the address is to, apparently in the singular to the angel of the church, namely the teaching elder.
Sure.
What do we make of that?
Yeah. Well, when he's addressing the churches collectively, yes, you do that the angels. I'm try not to read too much into that singular. I think it would be tempting to jump quickly to the conclusion that there was one person who had that role, and that may be a rather hasty conclusion to make that, Peter. You know, I think it probably was. There was one person. I don't think these churches are you know, churches of hundreds. They may be churches of 10, 15, 20 people. I don't think they're... Ephesus, possibly different, but some of the others would have been potentially quite small churches. And to imagine that they had seven or eight elders and a couple of pastors is probably a bit unrealistic at this stage in the historical development of the church. So I think it may very well be one person who has that responsibility of teaching and preaching the gospel in each of the local churches.
So the letters are addressed to the minister or pastor or whomever in order that he would then pass that on to the church.
I think so, yeah.
Is in the singular because it's regarded as one body, would that be...
I think so, or the person who has particular overall responsibility for teaching. Because if you think about it, how is this going to happen? He's not going to send an email around the congregational email list. They're not even going to hand out a printed flyer. Someone is going to stand up and read this out aloud. I mean, that's how it's going to be delivered. So there's going to be one person doing that. Even if on other occasions another person might be teaching the congregation, there's going to be one person will actually stand up in the gathering or sit down in the gathering and read it. So there'll be one person doing that. Yes, my mind got thinking about just more broadly what was some of the pastoral models in the church. But maybe it might be best to answer the question in terms of how the message was physically delivered.
So we had a question from Andrew down the front here.
I know we got the answer in Henry, and I was telling you by angle, not if we need angle or a minute, but
my question is, Andrew is saying that an angel can be a heavenly angel and earthly angel.
Sure. Hypothetically, yes. I mean, the word angel, angelos, simply means messenger, and it can be used. I mean, there are instances in the Bible where the word is used and it's translated simply as messenger. And we don't think, because we're not prompted to, the translation doesn't prompt us to think. So in the Bible, angels can be either those supernatural beings that are sent from heaven, and I'll give an example of one. But the word also can be used to describe angels with a human face, sent by God, and that's God working in his mysterious providence to bring that about. Now, I mean, there are some, and you asked a question, there are some, and I'm not wanting to launch into a polemic one way or the other here, but there are faithful expositors of the scripture who do argue that this is to the heavenly beings that oversee the church. The problem I have with that, and I say this respectfully, and don't want to get bogged down into a polemic and in geology, is that there doesn't seem to be elsewhere in Scripture backing up for angels looking after particular churches. Jesus speaks about angels looking after the little ones, the little ones that are despised. The despised little ones in the kingdom, and Calvin has a helpful comment on that we shouldn't think of each individual child or even each individual believer having their specific guardian angel. I mean, that's where the idea of the guardian angel comes from, but rather what we should think about is how all God's angels, all of them, are sent as ministering spirits to protect, to care, to watch over all who believe. So, again, I'm linking that into Hebrews 1:14. So all God's angels are sent to do God's mysterious works. That's not quite the same as saying that each church has its own specific angel. So I would fall to the interpretation that I'm suggesting, because thinking of just how mechanically practically the letters were delivered to the seven churches by a human messenger. And also, it is not angels who preach the gospel. If I can ramble a little bit, when Peter is sent to the house of Cornelius, the angel doesn't go. The angel calls Peter and says, "Peter, you go." So angels are not sent to preach the gospel. We are sent to preach the gospel. Angels help us and support us and protect us. I believe that's, I think God can send human people to, you know, help us, but God also sends his heavenly angels. Often at times and in circumstances in ways that we do not see. But yes, his heavenly angels come and help us, protect us. They are sent for the sake of those who are inheriting salvation. Okay, well, the blessed and perfect fellowship that Adam and Eve had with their Maker. Yeah, Adam walked with God, and God walked with Adam. We're given just a little insight into what that must have been like, because it was without sin. So yes, I would think of that as a time when Adam enjoyed his first love with God. Yeah.
Sometime I was driving on a very busy road and my car just swerved across four lanes of traffic and it stopped. And after that I said to my pastor, oh, I said, I had a legion of angels watching over me. And he said, oh, you only need one. So what sort of you're talking about that?
Well, we do only need one. We do only need one, but God sends however many he wants to send. So there was a debate about how many angels would dance on the head of a pin. It was actually the medieval theologians the serious point is we do not know how many God sends to any particular incident. We just don't know. God knows, and that's what matters. And we know that God is able to protect his people.
Well, I mean, when I came, I was blacked out for maybe 10 seconds. But when I came to, I said, oh, you're taking me back to protect.
Yeah. Sure, absolutely. There's that wonderful story when John Patton and some of the missionaries were, I think it was on Tanna in the New Hebrides as it was, and the local tribal chief had promised that he was going to get the missionaries and kill them, and they knew they were coming that night, and they closed in around the mission house on the island. And the missionaries sat inside and prayed all night, and they waited, and nothing happened. But as the morning came, they melted away. And it was only later on, when that tribal chief was converted, that they realized what had happened. Because he asked them, he says, that night when we came to get you, there was this ring of men in shining garments standing around you. Who were they? And it was only then that it dawned on Patton that God had sent his angels, plural. So again, God knows, God addresses the situation, God deals with his infinite resources for the ultimate good of his people and the spread of his gospel.